prayed over there and he was buried over there. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man, Sayyid Abdullah Alai Sabzawari, the author of Mawahib al-Rahman fi Tafsir al-Quran. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher, Al-Muallim. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. See another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanah.
Information Society. Part 2. On April 18, 1943, Japanese Commander Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto left the Rabaul base in New Guinea for the Solomon Islands. It was Admiral's last flight. On his way to the island, 16 U.S. fighter jets appear in the sky and attack the Admiral. After the shooting, the plane wing falls apart and the Admiral's plane crashes in the woods. The question is, where did the planes come from? How was Yamamoto's direction revealed? As the Second World War was drawing to a close, Roosevelt died and his deputy, Harry Truman, assumed power. 4 months later, Truman issued an order for an atomic attack on Japan so the World War could end with the U.S. display of power. Truman was seeking power. The liberated lands were war booties, and in his opinion, peace was an opportunity for the next war. For the U.S., the Soviet Union was a hostile force. Yesterday's comrade became today's foe. In 1965, ARPA launched a project to create a real network. The technology was based on a theory by Paul Barron, breaking messages to smaller packages. After an extensive endeavor, finally, on October 29, 1969, efforts were made to link up the first two nodes and establish what was later named ARPANET. We typed the letter L and we asked, "Do you see the L?" They said yes. We typed O and asked, "Do you see the O?" And they said yes. Then we typed G and the system crashed. The first link between the California and Stanford universities was set up. It was a success. The network was invented. He said the complicated receivers and processors were secretly transferred in special diplomatic packages and bags to the embassies and were used for surveillance after being installed.
See that structure at the top? It looks something like an Indian teepee with the little lightning rods on top. I watched them build that. I watched them construct it.
Duncan Campbell confirmed his claims. The tools in the U.S. embassies in Geneva and Berlin were of the same type. This part of Echelon was named the stateroom. Echelon services were improving by the day, and Mike Frost had more to reveal. As ordered by Margaret Thatcher, Echelon was used to spy on two UK cabinet members as well. Echelon's footprints could be traced in Princess Diana's death and the Mossad's revenge against the Munich incident. In 2000, James Woolsey, the CIA director, asserted that because of financial concerns, Echelon was involved in spying on industries and business as well. It led to big agreements by Boeing, which made European companies and experts lose jobs. The U.S. was stealing the Europeans' jobs as well.
That America was stealing European jobs.
A European delegation took a trip to Washington, but the U.S. canceled all meetings and the committee had to cut the trip short. the U.S. refused to answer the demands. On September 11th, 2001, something extraordinary happened. Two planes crash into the World Trade Center Twin Towers. Everyone was speechless and emotional. No one saw the tower's engineered collapse. The Western media mobilized the international community. The perpetrators should have been arrested and executed. Because of such incidents, people would be under surveillance along with the terrorists. Everyone forgot how Echelon abused the circumstances. Echelon was unbelievably tasked with fighting terrorism. The war on terror started. After a while, the U.S. tried to form a coalition to launch an invasion on Iraq. Before that, Western officials considered Echelon's services meager and insignificant. But when Colin Powell sought to compel the U.N. Security Council members to launch an attack on Iraq by unveiling the conversation between Iraqi Ba'athist commanders about hiding chemical weapons, Echelon's unbelievable capabilities to record conversations came to light. The conversations could be converted into text. Echelon was higher than what was said. In 2003, the U.S. invaded Iraq, which led to the massacre of people. Julian Assange made a disclosure. After founding WikiLeaks, he took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy. The number of whistleblowers gradually increased. On June 5, 2013, young engineer Edward Snowden, who worked in the intelligence company Booz Allen Hamilton as a security contractor of the Defense Department, in an interview, made a huge revelation. The NSA had launched a large-scale surveillance program on everything, even social networks. The internet was not safe.
Targets the communications of everyone.
He proved that the security cooperation between Western countries amid the Cold War contained the most secret mysteries in the West. Protect America Act of 2007 led to the creation of a secret program, a program to gather two types of data, metadata and content from all conversations. The program was called PRISM. The conspiracy theory collapsed. There was a real plot going on. Google, which was the main research engine for many people to search, watch videos, and send emails, was at the heart of PRISM. All of the information and activities by users on the internet was recorded, and the NSA astonishingly had direct access to the data by Google and other internet giants like Facebook, Apple, Yahoo, and even small companies. It would easily save the data. The agency had worked a miracle. The coding software had become an agent of spying. For example, journalists used Tor software to hide their own identities. They were supposed to use Tor to not be tracked so their identities wouldn't be revealed, but that didn't happen. There was a big lie. Everything was right in front of the agency's organization. Only 10% of the internet was used by ordinary people, and the remaining 90% was being controlled by the NSA. Snowden disclosed facts about Bull Run and Q-Score. The programs were used for coding telecommunication and online data. They had a budget of $800 million. The situation was chaotic, and the issue was taken to the Senate. James Clapper was grilled in the Senate meeting. He was questioned if the NSA had recorded any information on U.S. citizens. Clapper said no. He was dismissed for wrong testimony. Things were even worse in Britain. Even though the UK intelligence agency had a system to identify coded telecommunication through cable networks, It was intensely after influencing Hotmail, Google, Yahoo, and Facebook. Their espionage program was Tempora, which started in 2008 and became operational in 2011. The other program was Edge Hill. These programs had unique features. They worked with advanced mathematical techniques. For example, Edge Hill, that cost $250 million a year, could crack emails, bank documents, and medical documents. It could penetrate VPNs and secure layers and was trying to penetrate 4G smartphones. This program would damage facilities on purpose. The software was really dangerous. Why were the facilities so vulnerable? According to U.S. laws, the companies were forced to send their products to the agency to test them for supervision. The NSA and the CIA would change the design and make the facility sent by the companies traceable and would turn them into spy tools. The NSA was seeking to carry on with its surveillance activities through free hubs and Wi-Fis, just like GPS devices. Verizon wireless software, with 100 million users, was also used as spyware. The documents showed that the agency had penetrated international standards that stress coding systems and had caused weaknesses in security standards. Snowden struck the coup de grace on the concept of standards and information technology. The NSA influenced international standards that encryption systems relied on, working covertly in 2006 to get its own version of draft security standards issued by National Institute of Standards and Technology, the NIST, and approved for worldwide use. Standard was at the service of the NSA. It was as if everyone was trying to take over in the espionage race. The FBI and CIA were well aware of the weaknesses of smart systems, but they wouldn't say anything about it for espionage purposes. They were taking advantage of the vulnerabilities.
I feel terrible about what happened to these Iraqi detainees.
I'd do it again in a minute.
George Bush's operation to get revenge for the 9/11 attacks started with widespread espionage activities. The basis for the espionage was the internet, but it wasn't the whole plan to get revenge. The U.S. was thirsty for power.
Either you are with us, or you are with the terrorists.
The slogan, either you're with us or against us, led to the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. The ground was paved for international intranets. The coalition of eyes was formed. The information was classified and was provided only in a limited amount after receiving guarantees. The game had started. After a year, a 27 terabyte database was built in the Bagram Air Base data center that would save regional information. The Polish soldiers who were deployed in Afghanistan went to distant and tough terrains the U.S. troops wouldn't go. They received a tracking device in return for their favor and tried to help the U.S. more. But they weren't allowed to join the intelligence coalition in Afghanistan. Poland, along with several other NATO member states, was on the red list. The English-speaking countries that had historical and cultural roots in English islands had closer cooperation with each other compared to other countries, even in the occupation of Afghanistan. The coalition for Iraq was different. As they had to face a larger population, the agency rolled up its sleeves and simultaneously spied on 4 to 5 million Baghdad residents. The White House, the Defense Department, the FBI and CIA had their own intranets. Gradually, it came to light that the number of the networks was much higher than already disclosed. Finally, top secret intranets that could transfer sensitive SCI information were unveiled. Interlink and Intellipedia were special software for the agency's staff to share information from all over the world. One of their favorite subjects was Iran's nuclear activities that led to the Stuxnet malware. The information also showed who was strongly against the invasion of Iraq and how different countries assessed their national information. In 2013, the CIA's budget to topple governments increased to $15 billion. The NSA, that was only assigned with digital operations, issued a bill of at least $10.5 billion. They claimed that their mission was to protect the United States' security.
Necessary to do the job to protect the American people from further attack.
The heavy investment on the NSA helped it become so advanced that in 2018, it could spy on all smartphones and completely control people and all cell phones. No phone was safe.
Are not especially good in protecting your privacy. Think right now.
What the NSA does has to do with encryption. It is the biggest employer of mathematicians in the world, either directly or indirectly. The NSA owns the biggest supercomputers in the world. The minimum amount of electricity bill in its headquarters in Maryland is $21 billion. The NSA supervises all processes of transfer of information in any shape or form. That is, an email sent from a room to the adjacent room is done under the watchful eyes of the NSA. Where does the NSA's power come from? Administratively, the NSA belongs to the Defense Department and works under the supervision of the DNI. The NSA's director is at the same time head of the Central Security Service as well. The NSA is an expert in signal intelligence and provides services to other intelligence agencies. The basis for the NSA's widespread activities are telecommunications and national security acts. The Telecommunications Act was ratified in 1996. The act stems from a 1934 act that's still binding. The president has the authority to control all communication in case of a threat posed by war. It means he can shut down the internet. But the internet is formed based on the activities of companies that provide internet services that are known as the internet's spinal cord. In 2010, U.S. senators claimed the right and ownership to the internet so they could shut it down as and when they wished. Put it to a vote to register the internet as a national asset. The motion was repealed without being put to a vote. The reason was the direct and indirect benefits of the internet for the U.S. The internet was a source of revenue and widespread espionage, so it couldn't be specific to a country. The U.S. economy was dependent on the internet, the NSA, and DARPA. In this economic model, the circumstances should lead everyone to anxiously use the internet. The internet was the attractive factor that facilitated other plans. It worked as a catalyst. On the one hand, shutting down the internet would cause concern in other countries and make them create their own national networks to transfer data. And making those facilities in other countries would reduce the possibility for espionage. So the national networks shouldn't have been created by other countries, and people shouldn't use them under the slogan of the Internet for All, so intelligence agencies could carry out their operations well. The U.S. spy agencies came into being according to the National Security Act and spread like wildfire. Soon, there were 17 main agencies and many more departments. The intelligence spending in the U.S. is provided under two programs, the National Intelligence Program and the Military Intelligence Program. The spending for the two programs increased from $72 billion in 2013 to about $86 billion in 2020. Officials behind the two programs and all other institutions were called the U.S. Intelligence Community, or the IC. The IC considers itself a federation of its own constituents. It sets the goals and priorities. It spends billions of dollars for different intelligence projects. Some programs are introduced as a 10-year espionage program, and some others are for longer periods. The IC power increased after the 80s, when analyzing data became a focal point, so it would help politicians by sifting through the information. In fact, it was discovering less expensive solutions to tackle America's problems. The information was fast increasing. Managing it was a tough challenge. The solution was investing on projects, the same policy that led to the creation of DARPA and advanced systems in the past decades. A project named Massive Digital Data Systems, the MDDS, was introduced. Universities were handed over control over the project. As IC demanded, Dr. Anita Jones, a scientist at the University of Virginia, became the director of DARPA. She had been on the board of directors at the Mitre firm since 1988, so she followed up on the project through Mitre. Huge finances were directly allocated to the best projects introduced. It gave a technological boost to Silicon Valley's tech companies. The most outstanding issue was a successful search engine to exactly find what they're looking for faster than other search engines. Professor Jeffrey Albin and his colleagues, who had previously worked with DARPA, referred two students to DARPA supervisors. They were really instrumental in ranking the pages, Sergey Brin and Larry Page. Brin and Page started their work with the funding for the Digital Library Initiative, the DLI, a multi-agency program sponsored by the National Science Foundation, NASA, and DARPA. Two intelligence directors were in charge of directing the program, and as the search was progressing, they held regular meetings with Brin. The funding by the NSA and CIA were indirectly transferred to their bank accounts and other projects. In their article in 1988, which was published in the Bulletin of the Technical Committee of the American Compute Society on Data Engineering, Page and Brin described page ranking methods and stated that the article was sponsored by the American Science Foundation. The amount awarded by the foundation was over $4.5 million. After a while, they unveiled Google. No one knew how it was related to intelligence agencies. In September 1998, two technology entrepreneurs invested $100,000 on Google each.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now let's listen to the speech of Sheikh Jafar Jafar.
Begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. We have been discussing the advice that our beloved Prophet had given to our first Imam alayhi salam. He says, وَالثَّالِثَ الْخَوْفْ مِنَ اللَّهِ عَزَّ ذِكْرُهُ كَأَنَّكَ تَرَاهُ. He says, the third is to fear, have khawf of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the type of khawf as if you see Him. You know, the fact is that a person, no matter how evil that person is, how depraved that person is, would not act the same way in front of people that they would in private. Yeah? Like, you know, like if a person, like if there's a security guard standing right there, most people wouldn't steal, but they would steal when there's nobody watching, right? If we knew there was cameras in here, none of you would like pick your nose or something. You know what I mean? Because you know there's a camera watching you, right? And so when we know that someone is watching us, we wouldn't act in that same way. If we can get to the point where we can literally see and experience that God is watching us, it would change the way you and I function. Completely change the way you and I function, right? And that's something that we have to develop. There's a really cool hadith from, again, our sixth Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Where he says, Khafillah, fear Allah ka'annaka tarah, like you see Him. Fear God as though you can see Him. Wa in kunta la tarahu fa innahu yaraka. But even though you may not see Him, know that He sees you. Yeah? Know that He sees you. And He doesn't stop there. He says, وَإِن كُنْتَ تَرَى أَنَّهُ لَا يَرَاك فَقَدْ كَفَرْتَ. That if you actually think that He cannot see you, then you have done kufr. You have disbelieved in Allah. Because Allah sees everything, right? Like we have this story that I know we all have heard from the time we were at madrasa, right? Like there was a teacher who told the students, do something. I don't know what it was. I don't know what the act was, but do something where no one will see you. So one student came back and said, I hid under a table. One student said, I hid into my closet, right? And they did all of this. And one student came back and he said, I couldn't. And he says, why? Why couldn't? He said, because God was watching me everywhere, right? And that student was me. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah? But that's the reality, right? Like the reality is that God sees us at all times. And that's something that we always have to be mindful of. And if we ever believe that in this particular moment, God is not seeing me, فَقَدْ كَفَرْتَ, the Imam says. You have done kufr, you have disbelieved. But then he says, وَإِن كُنْتَ تَعْلَمْ أَنَّهُ يَرَاكْ. That if you know and you are certain that God sees you, ثُمَّ بَرَزْتَ لَهُ بِالْمَعْصِيَةِ, and then you still have the guts to sin against Allah after you know that God sees you, فَقَدْ جَعَلْتَهُ مِنْ أَهْوَنِ النَّاذِرِ بَيْنَ إِلَيْكَ. That you have made God the most insignificant of lookers. Yeah? The most insignificant of people who see things. Imagine how that is. If I know, guaranteed, Allah is watching me, and yet I have the ability to sin, what does that tell me or you about what I think of God? I think He's insignificant. Who cares if you see me? I'm still going to do this. And that is scary, yeah? That is scary. That's a demonstration that our faith needs a lot of work. Yeah, a lot of work to then get to that point. And so we start. How do we fear God? We fear God the type of fearing that is if He sees me. All we need are reminders for this, because we have, from the time we are children, been taught that God sees everything, that God hears everything. Innahu Sami'ul Basir. We are constantly reminded that indeed He is all hearing, all seeing. The problem that we get into is that the moment I want to sin, I forget that God is watching me at that point. Because if I truly remembered at that point, I don't think most of us would sin. I don't think we have that kind of guts. I say the same thing about Fajr, you know? That at Fajr time, if I just pick up the habit or get into the habit to say that God is waiting for you, God is waiting for you, none of us will snooze at that point. None of us. Because I don't think we have that kind of guts to snooze. And we know, the problem is we forget at the time of Fajr because our sleep has taken over. Or when our desires have taken over, we forget that God is watching. We just have to find reminders, right? And that's up to us to find that reminder. I think, like, create your own alarm that comes out. God is watching, right? God is waiting, whatever. Like, if you can do something like that, I'm sure you can create your own alarms, right? Or if you know, for example, your vice or my vice is to, we watch inappropriate things on the laptop, then have like a big eye on your laptop. Every time you open it, you see this eye as a reminder. These are just examples, yeah? But you have to find your own example to remind you that God is watching. Because I promise you, if you can remind yourself that God is watching, we wouldn't sin, right? And that's the level of faith that we need to have. If we have that level of faith, then that secondary khawf of being distant from God will become much easier to reach if I have the first level of khawf in my life. Sallu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Ma salli ala Muhammadin wa Ali Muhammad. Then we come to the fourth advice. Wa rabi'a, kasratul buka min khashyatillah. Yeah? To cry frequently or to cry a lot. Out of the khashya of Allah. Now again, like most translations will translate khashya as fear as well. We translated khawf as fear. Both words can't really mean fear. They both may produce fear, right? Khashya is more of being in awe, yeah, of humility. A humility of such sorts that I fear doing something to ruin that relationship with God, because I respect Him so much. So it's a different type of fear, but we'll discuss that. But then the Prophet says that kathratul buka min khashyatillah, a lot of tears out of the fear of God or being in awe of Allah, yubna laka bi kulli dam'atin alfa baitin fil jannah. Subhanallah. That Allah will build for you, for every tear, 1,000 homes in paradise. Yeah? This is not a small thing, yeah? Not a small thing. Now what will we do with 1,000 mansions? Allahu A'lam. Yeah? But the fact is that I would get Jannah, right? But I think more than the reward of 1,000 mansions is the value of that one tear. Imagine how powerful that one tear for God is, right? Now here, what's the difference between khawf and khashya, right? As we said, khawf is translated as fear, khashya is translated as fear. But what's the difference, right? The difference is, according to linguists and ulama here, they tell us that khawf is generally a type of fear over something where we don't have full knowledge about it. Okay? So for example, I don't have full knowledge about the Day of Judgment. I have general knowledge. So I fear the Day of Judgment. I don't have full knowledge of the effects of my actions, and so I fear these actions. I don't have full extent knowledge of the wrath of God, so I fear the wrath of God. So any time that I lack the full knowledge behind something, I would automatically fear that, right? This is true for anything, whether you play sports, whether you do something, the fear, you don't really fear your opponent, but the time you fear your opponent is when you can't figure him out or her out, right? And there's something strange about that person. Khashya is a fear that is attained after knowledge. When you gain knowledge about something and you say that that being deserves respect, that being deserves awe, then it automatically creates a feeling of humility and respect for that being, where you fear ruining that relationship. This is why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Surah Al-Fatir says in verse 28, إِنَّمَا يَخْشَ اللَّهَ مِنْ إِبَادِهِ الْعُلَمَاء أحسنت. That the only ones who truly have khashya of God are the ulama, right? Are the ulama. Now ulama doesn't mean scholars as such. It means those who have knowledge. The more knowledge you have of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the more you will be produced, or the more inclined you would be to have this khushu, this being in awe of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
I've been waiting, I've been hurting, 'cause I've been falling, I need your help. My heart is breaking, so tired of crying, Lord I'm calling, I need your help. Astaghfirullah, forgive me, Allah.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear ladies, welcome to a new episode of Muslim Lady. Well, this is IRB English Radio. I am Asma, playing your host for today, and Sister Zainab is here with me. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Wa alaikum assalam, and assalamu alaikum to you and your listeners.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Well, we are going to talk about the reasons of why a woman would take all that much of risk, all that much of difficulties to get into a job.
We talked about so many things, like women being in workplace, the challenges she faces, or
they are... We penetrated actually into it because we talked too much about the guilt and the mental breakdown that she's going to face.
Exactly. And I think that was important to go through these things. There's a much to talk about, but like we just had a gist of all. Why she's putting herself into that much trauma physically, emotionally... there are many reasons for many kind of, there are different kind of women working in the society, and every woman has her own reason.
Yeah.
But the main reason, as per the research, as per the statistics that we have available, is that she wants to be a financial help to the family.
Yeah. So the first reason is that life in modern day is very difficult. So one person working outside is not going to be enough for the family to provide them with too much of facilities.
Exactly. And that's why we have, again, so much in Quran, so much in narrations about the charity, about helping each other, about being, you know, shoulder to each other, about being kind and generous. We have so much about generosity, like Imam Hassan alayhi salam would give his entire property to wives and half of his property once, and then, you know, the most generous is called Karimul Ahlul Bayt, the generous of the Ahlul Bayt. Imams teach us from their practical way of life they have lived to be generous. When we are generous, maybe someone who is forced to work outside, he does not like or does not wish to or is not able to manage or is not able to face all those challenges that we have been talking about, maybe it would be a help.
Yeah, so again, we come to the very factor that Islam recommends all of us to take care of each other.
Take care of each other,
so
yeah.
So if my sister does not have enough of money and I have it, I can share half of my things with her in a way that we would make up for all the things that she does not have.
It was so beautiful. I heard someone saying that she was a very rich lady. She said that, all my life I had been earning money, and the more amount of money I used to earn, I did not feel very good. But the moment I felt good was
the moment I gave them away.
When I shared it.
Yeah.
And when I started taking care. So earning did not make me mentally happy. It was giving away that made
exactly,
me happy.
Exactly, yeah.
So that's what Islam also recommends you. So Islam is actually very much keen about your mental health, which will make you feel good. Which activity of yours will release feel-good hormones in your body. Islam is very keen about it. So our teachings are not baseless. Our narrations are not baseless. They are very perfect at their place. So another reasons why a woman goes out who works. Now, we are not here to degrade all women, like while you're working, you should not be working, you should be staying at
home. No, of course not.
So another reasons are like she wants to explore her skills at a social level.
You know,
it's very important as per the
leader. That's justifying.
Yeah, a leader, as per the supreme leader of Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, he says that it's better for a society if we have women as doctors.
Exactly, yeah.
As in the, daycare institutions, in the childcare institutions, mm-hmm. if we have women, it's far better than we have men over
and
there.
And we as women know how great it is when you go to a doctor, when you go to, I don't know, a place, that the person in front of you is going to be another woman just like you.
Exactly.
You would
like
feel
I remember I skipped many times checking my blood pressure in my country because the opposite person sitting in front of me as a doctor was not from my gender, was like a male or was not a female. So I had to skip an important checkup. I had to skip, like, I don't know, during my pregnancies, or sometimes it was really important to have that checkup because as you
did not feel comfortable with that.
Exactly. As you said, like, you know, how good it feels.
It's a blessing to have women in society who are just helping the other women, you know, in being a doctor, in being a teacher.
For me, it was a very amazing thing to be, you know, coming to this country and seeing women excel, explore, and that too in hijab. That was the most amazing thing for me.
So I guess this second reason that you just mentioned is the most honorable, appreciable, and admirable reason of why a woman goes to hijab.
Exactly, because even if she is now going, because in India, probably you won't accept that, okay, I will go to a higher level job or I will go to a higher level profession maintaining my hijab, or in many other countries like that. But in Iran, I was amazed because in the very first flight that I came, the woman was the pilot and had to in hijab. Mm-hmm. So that was again, amazing.
It's a matter of pride for all the women.
Exactly. Then another thing that was amazing for me over here was that seeing all the women running an institution, which is one of the topmost institutions, one of the topmost seminary schools, which accepts students internationally. And I saw from a servant to a head of the institution, all are women, and that too, they are all in hijab, and that too, this kind of climate, because I was not able to tolerate it for some 1 month or so. It was so hot, but I was like, they are so comfortable in doing this.
Yeah, and we also have those hospitals that are just instructed by women.
That was another amazing thing I found at the time of my delivery here. That I went to a hospital and from the someone who gives me slippers, makes me prepared for getting getting checked up by a doctor, and to the expertise, all are women.
So according to what we say, I guess it's pretty much clear that we do not say that women working outside the home is not a good thing and they should quit that. Of course not. All we care about is the mental health of a woman who's working outside the home, and this balance that is very difficult for her to create between her family and her work. We are going to go for a break, and then after that, we'll go for the rest of the story.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Yes, Muslim ladies, welcome back. Well, women are great creatures who can do too much of responsibilities at the very same time. And this is very astonishing. As for me, even thinking about it makes me so scared because doing too many things at the very same time seems to be impossible. But many women are doing that perfectly. I mean, yes, their family are going to tolerate too much. I mean, the kids, they're going to see their mothers less than the other children who've got their mothers at home. And maybe the husband have got a lot of things to say as well. But they're doing an important part in society. They are actually fulfilling the missions that has been put on their shoulders.
So yeah, we were talking about the reasons why actually a woman goes out for work. So yeah. Some of the women really don't have, that kind of thinking that I want to be a financial help to the family. But they have this feeling of being independent. They want be independent. And many other are there who don't have all these reasons, but they simply want to escape loneliness.
This is also another reason.
Yeah. And seriously, there should be some of the health groups in the society who should address to mental health of a woman, which is very, very important. And because of this, you know, just to escape loneliness, women go out to work and then they face all those challenges we talked about or many more challenges than that.
So you ignore the home, you put it aside just because you want to ignore things.
Exactly.
Also, there's another reason that I would love to add, which is the influence of media. Sometimes many women think, okay, she has got money. I mean, she's living in a perfectly wealthy family. But still, she feels that I have to go for a job.
Which is a policy, you know, with the slogan of freedom of women. They actually want to control the population. They have engaged her so much into the work. They have engaged her so much into the, you know, economic
life. So you mean that she is busy enough that she does not think about creating a family or breeding even.
Exactly.
And then her psychological clock is going to tick at a certain age. And when she's alone...
Again, like as we said, then she has to escape her loneliness. Then she has to escape all those traumas. She again has to work. We have these propagandas today that women should be free. Women should be, you know, there's gender equality. There's gender injustice.
Yeah. You know, and that's making a family. So sad. The woman that is working too much, the woman that is giving too much of herself to this work that, to these jobs that she's taking, after a certain time, she's going to get old. She can no longer go for making a family or having children. Then she becomes lonely. And then at that time, all the jobs that she has been through, all the work that she has done, are not going to do her anything. And this is really tragic.
Exactly. It is. And, thinking about the economic growth of their country, that's another government reason that they want women forced to be in, because half of the population consists of women, obviously. And when half of the population is not working, that means your economic GDP is not much. You don't have that gross production development. economically. So they drive women into their work, especially they know that women work for less salaries.
Yeah.
So because women really don't have this, I just said there are many reasons that they want to be independent, or they just want to explore, or many want to gain experience, and they don't demand much salaries. But men are not like that. Mm-hmm. When men work, they work for salaries. They work for huge salaries. They demand high. But from women, they're easygoing, and they're like, they see, no, she is cheap. She is, she's affordable, and we can use her beauty, actually, to drive more.
Yes, exactly.
Much of the money.
To attract more of customers.
Exactly.
And, what is even more sad is the fact that when you think about it, when you come to scrutinize into this fact, you come to see the story as this, that too many of us are working as servants, unconsciously actually. We are being the servants of a higher and bigger power.
Exactly.
And this is very sad, really, especially for women.
As the, again, Supreme Leader calls it a Zionist conspiracy, which is plotted, which is put into action by the United States and other superpowers like that. And it is definitely a conspiracy. Yeah. It is definitely a plot.
So they cover their wild intentions with beautiful slogans, just like equality of genders and women are as the same of men and things like that. But what the truth is and what we see in reality is the fact they are using women for their own benefits.
And today, women all around the world have realized this. You can see that the biggest manifestation of that is the protests on the International Women's Day all around the world.
Yeah, yeah, that's very true. So I guess as women, whatever we're doing, we said that there are too many jobs that many women are doing, and we are so much respecting them because their presence in society is just like a blessing for every woman, and they're helping. But aside from that, there are too many jobs that if they did not exist, nothing would go wrong in this life. You know what I mean? Many women are actually being a part of a bigger game and they do not know it. So I guess we have to think about these issues more and more. And yeah, take care of yourself. And until another session, wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
I know I'm waiting for something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Hidden Files.
One 100 years ago, wars were fought with tanks, rifles, machine guns, chemical weapons, explosive devices, etc. Well, fast forward, and wars have gotten much more sophisticated. And at times, the most lethal weapon is intangible. From misinformation, media campaigns to sanctions, the tools of war have changed to target nations and to cause upheaval from within first, and then add the more common hardware tools to the chest, like WMDs, IEDs, phosphorus bombs and missiles, and, great technological advancement like those. Just as there are alleged rules to traditional warfare that are not followed, so are there alleged rules to this new form of warfare. Not targeting civilian populations and not inflicting collective punishment and not committing crimes against humanity. These are all nice concepts, which are not always followed. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today we will look at a form of war which many do not understand the effects of, sanctions, and especially the unilateral sanctions regime of the United States. According to the United Nations, sanctions are meant to be used as a last resort. It says it is a response to stopping extremism, curbing smuggling, and massive human rights violations. However, what has been the norm of the UN is that countries which are members of the Security Council are not sanctioned, and the sanction of others depends on the political and geostrategic interests of Security Council members. Well, the main sanction regime today comes from the United States and its unilateral sanctions. Washington sanctions a country and pressures other countries from dealing with the targeted sanctioned country, usually by economic threats or even worse. According to the United Nations, a proliferation of secondary sanctions has resulted in a growing fear of sanctions and overcompliance, leading to serious adverse effects on the human rights of millions of people around the world. Secondary sanctions are intended to prevent third parties, states, commercial entities, and individuals from trading with countries that are subject to sanctions issued by another country. We will talk about the legality of these unilateral sanctions a little bit later in this show.
Currently, a third of the world's population is affected by U.S. sanctions. Since 1990, the U.S. has imposed unilateral sanctions in over 20 countries. Countries that try to have independent policies from the United States are the most affected. Countries like Cuba, which has been on the U.S. sanctioned list for 61 years now. Iran, which was the most sanctioned country in history until the start of the Russia-Ukraine war. Iran has been on the U.S. sanctions list for 43 years. And now, Russia is the most sanctioned country in the world. Then there is Venezuela, which has suffered for years from U.S. sanctions due to its revolutionary policies. According to the Center for Economic and Policy Research, 40,000 Venezuelans have died due to U.S. sanctions.
I'd like to welcome our first guest to the show.
Cindy Sheehan. Cindy Sheehan is a peace and social justice advocate who became internationally prominent after her son Casey was killed in Iraq in 2004. She set up a peace camp near then-President George Bush's vacation home in Crawford, Texas. She is an author and hosts The Soapbox on Substack.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Cindy. I'd like to hear your opinion on the way sanctions have been used to cause maximum pressure on countries and their populations.
Sanctions are supposedly put in place because the United States, the State Department, the politicians, the media, you know, whatever, this big class of propagandists, they'll say that so-and-so is killing his own people, so-and-so is a brutal dictatorship, blah, blah, blah. And so the United States, they're, you know, and Cuba is a perfect example of this. There's been a blockade in Cuba almost as long as I have been alive. And they're supposedly placed there so the people will get so disadvantaged and so upset with their own governments that they'll rise up against their governments. But as you know, a victim living in a place where there's been really harsh sanctions, that's not exactly what happens. And it actually is harmful to the people. And I believe, and I've talked to many people in the countries that you mentioned, and I've been to Cuba many times, it makes them stronger to stay firm against the empire, against imperialism, against neoliberalism.
Well, the irony of these U.S. sanctions is that the American people actually don't benefit from what their country is doing to others. So who's benefiting from this, Cindy?
The war profiteers, the globalists, the capitalists. They're the ones that profit. But we've seen here in the United States that even though it was a slow march to the collapse of our economic system here in the United States, especially since 2011. We've seen since the start of COVID, we've seen since the brutal sanctions put against Russia this year, that it is actually now starting to reflect here in the United States with gas prices and inflation, hyperinflation, the reduction of services, the crumbling of our infrastructure. So these